we've been taking the book of Philippians and taking it one passage at a time and taking the whole book of Philippians. Sometimes I know we kind of go into a book and we say, okay, we're going to highlight certain passages. In the book of Philippians, we're going through every verse. So I was assigned Philippians chapter 2, verse 19 to 30. And so on my vacation, I started opening that scripture and started looking at it and going, man, like, I think the best part of this chapter, Kevin's got it 2 weeks ago, and Peter had it last week, and man, I'm just getting the leftovers here. Like, how am I going to preach from this stuff? And I mean, it's almost like I was just going, I don't know whether there's anything here. Like, you know, does that sound heretical? I mean, there always is something there in Scripture. But hey, here's the thing. I started looking at it, and I'm going, there is so much richness in this passage this morning. And I just needed to drill down a little bit deeper or pay a little bit more attention to what was being said there. And realize there's a sermon here that I am so excited about sharing this morning because I think it has such incredible relevance to the topic of joy. It really does. And the whole theme that we start seeing, this passage is about relationships between Paul and Timothy. Paul is the guy who wrote the book. And Epaphroditus, kind of a challenging name to say. But when I took a look at that, I went, what is being expressed in this passage is heartfelt friendship, and really in many ways a model and a pattern of what friendship looks like. And I think sometimes we don't think, you know, kind of objectively about friendships. We just, yeah, people I know, okay. But I want this morning, maybe it's going to be a chance for you to just kind of step back and say, what are the friendships that I have in my life, and what are they doing to restore my friendship? What kind of friend am I being to other people, and how does this relate to the joy level in my life? Because the reality is, like, life can become pretty joyless, pretty kind of plain and practical without the rich texture of relationships and without friendships that really matter. And what we see in this passage is that Paul, he was a go-at-it sort of guy. He was a guy who got things done. He was all about production. He moved. But in the process of moving, he moved with people. He had especially some friends that he chose, Timothy and Epaphroditus, to walk with him. And I think that was part of the source of his joy. The reality is, in today's world, we can move faster than ever, we can communicate faster, we can produce more than ever before in every generation, and yet there's a malady that's throughout our culture, in North America especially, and that's the malady of loneliness, of feeling very much alone. And I think oftentimes, what we've ended up with in this culture is kind of a we're connecting, we're, you know, emailing, we're texting. Those are all good things, by the way. I think they can be incredible enhancers to relationship. But sometimes I think that can help us to sort of, you know, glide through and kind of hyperplane through life and not really drill down deep and really enjoy the richness of friendship. I found it interesting as I was talking about this subject with my wife, Suzanne. She's taking a course at Trinity Western right now at the seminary there in psychology. And her psych prof was talking this week about a term that he's coined, connectivity fatigue, that there's something happening that he's kind of exploring, and he's not anti, technology and all that sort of thing, but he's saying there's a fatigue that's happening that's a little different right now. And it was interesting to kind of explore that, and he's going to be writing an article on that, and I'm really interested to read that. But I think we're connecting, but are we finding really supportive relationships? Somebody wrote, we yearn for supportive relationships, but conclude that they are unattainable. Somebody else wrote, we are breathing in the odorless gas of a postmodern world, of this kind of world that we're living in. And Paul invites us to choose joy. And he says, one of the ways that I found joy is through these friends of mine. Let me introduce you to Timothy and Epaphroditus. So we're going to read the passage and then go from there. Philippians chapter 2, verse 19, it says, if the Lord is willing, I hope to send Timothy to you soon for a visit. Then he can cheer me up by telling me how you're getting along. I have no one else like Timothy who genuinely cares for your welfare. All the others care only for themselves and not for what matters to Jesus Christ. But you know how Timothy has proved himself. Like a son with his father, he has served me with me in preaching the good news. I hope to send him to you just as soon as I find out what is going to happen to me here. And I have confidence from the Lord that I myself will come to see you soon. Meanwhile, I thought I should send Epaphroditus back to you. He is a true brother, co-worker, and fellow soldier. And he was your messenger to help me in my need. I'm sending him because he has been longing to see you, and he was very distressed that you heard that he was ill. And he certainly was ill. In fact, he almost died. But God had mercy on him and also on me, so that I would not have one sorrow after another. So I am all the more anxious to send him back to you, for I know that you will be glad to see him, and then I will not be so worried about you. Welcome him with Christian love and with great joy, and give him honor, the honor that people like him deserve. For he risked his life for the work of Christ, and he was at the point of death while doing for me what you couldn't do from far away. Timothy and Epaphroditus, two great friends. And as we look at this passage, we see some intentionality about what is going on here. And the people that Paul chose for his life, you can see something, a hallmark of them, and we find it in verse 20, is, I have no one else like Timothy who genuinely cares for your welfare. If there's any foundation for friendship, and maybe this is kind of like a duh, yeah, of course, it's genuine care. I think it's really important to kind of do a self-analysis, and I don't look at myself and go, do I genuinely care about other people? The reality is that people who genuinely care for others win lots of friends. That if we take an interest in what's going on in other people, Paul, he's kind of prone to hyperbole here, and I think part of the reason he says there's no one else here that cares for you like Timothy does. But I think, you know, he's talking about a unique relationship to that, and we'll get to that. But he's just pointing out that what it's about is caring about other people. If we're really taking an interest in other people, friendships explore out of that. They grow out of that. If we're just looking for friendships for what they can do for us, that's a friendship killer. But when it's all about, you know, I really have a genuine concern about what's going on in your life. Timothy was that sort of guy. And Paul says, that's the kind of guy I choose to be a friend. That's the guy I'm walking with and going to battle with. Later on with Epaphroditus, it talks about his illness. And it's interesting when you see what Epaphroditus is concerned about when he's ill. It's not like, oh, poor me, you know. Can you get my mom? It's not that kind of thing. It's like, I care about what other people are thinking about. I care about their concern for me and my illness. That was the kind of guy Epaphroditus was. And it's a challenge for us to think about our worlds and to say, how much is it all about me? Is that what it's really about? It's interesting. There was a study done by the New York City Telephone Company where they listened in on phone calls, which should give us pause to consider right off the start. But they took 500 calls to find out which word was used most often. Guess what word was used most often in 500 phone calls? I, right? 3,990 times. We think I, right? We think my world. What's going on here? And where friendship is built is when we go, you know what? I'm going to be concerned. I'm genuinely concerned about what's going on in other people's lives. Good friends come out of genuine care for the other person. Dale Carnegie says, you can make more friends in 2 months by becoming interested in other people than you can by trying to get other people interested in you. You know, I think so oftentimes we come into friendships and we think, you know, I've just got to share my story. That's all about what I'm doing, Have you noticed that great friends are people who just go, I'm going to listen. I'm going to take a genuine interest in what's going on. I think there's something to be said about saying, God, can you just kind of help me self-monitor here a little bit? Is it just my story? Is it just about me when I'm entering into friendships? Could that be maybe killing it a little bit here? And then to say, you know, God, can you start to build a genuine care for others in my life? You know, I think sometimes if we're really honest with ourselves, I know if I'm going, I don't really care. What we really need is to know that our deepest parts of our person are cared by a friend, it says in the Bible, who sticks closer than a brother. I think the great thing about being a Christ follower is knowing the friendship that Jesus gives to us. That somehow if we have that rock solid foundation of knowing that Jesus is our friend, that genuinely cares for us, that will build into us that kind of care and that kind of love that will bubble out and genuinely care for others as well. You know, 2 weeks ago, Kevin spoke on the first passage of the first part of chapter 2. And really what Paul is doing at the end of this chapter is explaining kind of in personal relational terms what he illustrated when Jesus took on the form of a servant and came and died for us. Though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. This is Paul kind of saying, these are the kind of people who are modeling that in our lives. We need those kind of people around us. And we need to become those kind of people. People who say, you know what, I'm going to genuinely care for you. And where do we find that? We find that when our hearts are deeply touched and genuinely cared for by our friend Jesus. And I want to invite you, if you're here this morning and that relationship hasn't started yet, it starts simply by inviting him to come into our lives and to say, you know what, God, I want you. I know that you cared for me. You cared enough to die for me. And I want to let that sink into my heart. Could you, even if that is a, if there's a mental barrier to that, could you just even bypass some of that intellectual stuff and just tell my soul that I'm cared for? On a very human level, that's what we're all looking for. And you know, on a very human level, what Jesus invites us to, I think so oftentimes we feel like we have to bring our perfected self or our unselfish self to Jesus. He is that one friend that we can bring our selfish self to and just say, God, I have a need for this. I have a need. He doesn't count the I's in our prayers. He really is inviting us to take everything to him. And I think the great thing about that relationship with Jesus is we bring that to Jesus. He meets us as a deep friend. And we're able to come with from a sense of strength to other friendships, going, you know what? I can take this to others. I've been able to kind of go through my litany of challenges with Jesus. And now I can come to others and hear theirs as well. That's the great thing about having a friendship with Jesus. And we're invited to that. We're invited to that. Now, after talking about that foundation for friendship, I want to talk about the kinds of friendships, the aspects of friendship that Paul enjoyed with these guys. And I think it's important to look at our friends. You know, the wonderful thing that we get to do as people is in many ways choose our closest friend, right? I mean, there's a sense in which there's this world that we live in and our colleagues and the people that we go to school with and the people even that we're in church with and everything. And everyone is that kind of a friend. But there's a way of looking at it too. And I think Paul had this, we find that in this passage, this way of, you know what, these are what's special to me about these friends. And I see two characteristics in each of these guys, Timothy and Epaphroditus, two aspects of their friendship, which is so cool. It was neat this morning, actually, sitting in a coffee shop with Kevin, and Kevin's going off to Ontario, his birthplace where he grew up, and what he's looking for is connecting with all these friends in Ontario. And he mentioned one very close friend who's picking him up at the airport, and he didn't use these words, but I'm going to use these words, a kindred spirit. Now, I know Anna Green Gable uses those words too, but you use them too, good. You know, there is something very cool about finding a friend who really knows you, who just gets you, who things just flow because they understand you. And they're just, there's another translation actually. I love the New Living Translation. You'll notice that mostly we use that around here. There's lots of great translations out there. And sometimes, you know, there's different Greek words and how do you translate them. But I think on this verse, the New Living Translation doesn't do this verse justice. I found another translation that says this for verse 20. I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare. From what I understand, the Greek word actually can be translated same-souled. Same-souled. It's that kind of equal spirit. It's that kind of like-mindedness that goes, we just get each other. And, you know, people who have that with each other, they don't have to explain that. They just know that it happens. And I think, you know, what can bring such joy to our lives, just increase our joy, when we actually make time to enjoy and just live in those relationships, to maybe prioritize them, to say, you know what, if there's a joy aspect of my life that I'm missing, maybe I just need to get around that person who just gets me. And Paul had this with Timothy. He described Timothy as that kind of person. He was the kind of guy who, you know, if Paul sent him out on a mission and Timothy would describe it, he'd go, I know exactly what you're talking about. Oftentimes it's not somebody who has exactly the same temperament or exactly the same, you know, skills and that sort of thing, but it's just somebody who you know gets you and you get them. And, you know, the Bible makes a point. It's a very earthy kind of book that really makes a point of highlighting that. And you go to the Old Testament and you find the relationship of David and Jonathan. I think it was that kind of relationship. When you look at 1 Samuel 18, it says in 1 Samuel 18 that after David had finished talking with Saul, he met Jonathan, the king's son. There was an immediate bond between them, for Jonathan loved David. You know, there's something very, very soul refreshing, very joy infusing in our lives when we're able to take time to spend time with those kind of people in our lives. And I think in this world where there's such an obsession with, you know, sex and sexual attraction, and people are always looking for that one person, maybe that lover, you know, that soulmate, we miss out on the incredible richness of this kind of relationship. You know, same gender, just that appreciates each other, that knows each other, that, you know, that person's almost like living inside of my head, and you know it. And it's a wonderful thing, and when you find that, it's a rare thing. We have many acquaintances in our lives, maybe several good friends, but when you have that, enjoy it, live it, use that. See what God's doing in and through that in your life. That's a great thing. There's another aspect to that relationship that Paul had with Timothy, and it was also of a mentor. You also read that in verse 22. It says, "But you know how Timothy has proved himself. Like a son with his father, he has served with me in preaching the good news." In a whole bunch of other passages, you see this kind of mentor relationship kind of worked out between Paul and Timothy. Timothy came from Derbe or Lystra. It turns out that his mother was a Christ follower, Eunice, and his grandmother, Lois, also was. She was Jewish. His father was Greek. And it seems that Timothy grew up in this kind of home. And I think in some ways, Timothy might have wondered, you know, can God really use me when I'm from this kind of home? Maybe there's not a lot explained, but might have been not the regular kind of family connection. And what's incredibly encouraging is that no matter what kind of background we come from, no matter what our family of origin is, God can do incredible things through us. He did incredible things through Timothy. He used Timothy in some profound ways. And what's so cool is I think Timothy was a teachable guy who right away looked at Paul and said, hey, there's a guy I can learn from. And Paul mentored him. Paul took that opportunity to really help him along. And he describes him as my son, whom I love, in another passage, 1 Corinthians. They've been through a lot together. Timothy had accompanied Paul on his travels, including his journey to Philippi. Timothy had spent time in prison with Paul. He was associated with Paul at least 5 letters. And when Paul wanted to send information, advice, or encouragement, he often sent Timothy because he knew, I can trust this guy. I've worked with him. You know, our world is most changed one relationship at a time. When we come alongside of another person and we build into their lives, or we see them somehow building into our lives, we say, you know what, I'm going to find somebody who's a little bit further along, maybe in their spiritual journey. Maybe along, you know, might be somebody also in business or in family. And we say, you know, I can learn from that person. There's a richness to our lives when we say, I'm going to make that intentional. Whatever it takes, I'm going to set up some appointments. It might at times feel kind of, you know, contrived, but I'm going to take the time. And oftentimes when that connection happens, we realize, you know, that person is really building into me. It's that kind of person that you look at and you say, you know what? That's a person I can learn so much from. That person is the person who represents the greatest possibility and stability in my life. And maybe that person, too, helps us to give us the truest picture of ourselves. I want to invite Wally and Sylvia to come up right now. Wally and I work together in the office. Many of you have met him. He's actually handing out envelopes this morning, too. So if you and his wife, Sylvia. And it's been wonderful to get to know Wally and Sylvia recently. And we're actually starting a life group together right now. And I've just enjoyed the beginnings of a relationship and a friendship with these guys so much. And as we got talking a little bit at the office and stuff, I thought, you know what, I'd love for people to hear a little bit of your guys' story. And especially in this area of mentorship. I know you've been in contexts where you've both been able to be a mentor and also be mentored. And just ask them, maybe you could start, Wally, and just share with us a little bit about that.
Sure. When I came out of Bible school and was in my first pastorate, I thought to myself, I've got to find my mentor, right? I was on fire, I was ready to roll, and thought, I got to find that Paul, that spiritual giant, Billy Graham or Peter Nichol or, you know, somebody who just, you know, knew it all and had been in ministry for a long time and could mentor me. But the reality is those people are few and far between, and I didn't find that person, and I was... For the better part of a year, I was really disappointed, thinking, come on, God, I'm ready. Like, when is Billy Graham going to come knock on my door and say, I want to mentor you, Wally? But that wasn't happening. And then God began to open my eyes and made me realize, you know what, I'm putting different people in place in your life now already who can mentor you. Maybe not the big spiritual giant, but they can mentor you in this. This person can mentor you in this area. This person can mentor you in this area. Mm-hmm. And two in particular, in my first pastor in Vancouver, really stuck out. Actually, parents of friends of mine. And one of them was someone who really took an interest sort of in my, for lack of a better term, public life. Like, he would come and he would meet with me on a weekly basis and say, you know, when you're up there, you're talking like a 20-year-old using slang, and the 80-year-old people had no idea what you're talking about, you know? Like, just things like that. And he would pour into my life, like, what was it like to be a pastor to different generations of people? And then there was another friend, parent of a friend, and he really poured into my spiritual life. He met with me on a regular basis and just wanted to know what was happening inside. What was God doing in my life? What was God teaching me? And how was my personal walk? He wasn't concerned with all the outside stuff. He just wanted to make sure things were good spiritually on the inside. And so I learned early on that you may not find that perfect spiritual mentor like Paul, Timothy had Paul, but be very aware that God's putting different people in your life at different times to lead you along the way.
That's great. Thanks.
Well, I talked a bit about being mentored, and I just want to talk a little bit about mentoring itself. I had the opportunity to have both in my life, which is a very huge blessing. And when I was mentoring, somebody came to me who was in a leadership program at Trinity and wanted a formal mentoring process. And it was really an eye-opener as to how much can be done through the mentoring process. And a really structured process, even though I've also done unstructured, is really helpful for accountability, for just a regular checkup, spiritual checkups, and understanding where somebody's at. And through that relationship, we were able to go really deep and talk about relationships with others and build on that friendship and grow both of us in many ways. And it was such a blessing to me as well as to that person to be a part of that relationship. And I think even if it's an informal relationship, I think it's still a really important part of your life to grow in the spirit and also to grow in relationship. And I think both have huge benefits through that process.
That's awesome. Thanks a lot, Willie and Sylvia. That's great. Good to hear you guys' story a bit. That's great. Yeah, give them a hand. It's good. Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote, "What we need more than anything else is not textbooks, but text people. It is the personality of the teacher which is the text that the pupils read, the text they will never forget." You know, I think we can think about that and say, who could be a textbook for me? Who can I be a textbook for in their lives as well? Who might be reaching out? And I could say, hey, you know what? I'm going to just come alongside of that person. I'm going to reach into them. Coaches and teachable people, they find each other. Anyone with questions will soon find people with answers. It begins to happen. If we enter into life going, you know what, I don't have it all together. I need relationships. I'm open to be changed and see somebody else speak into my life. If we look for those kind of people and are open to that kind of person reaching out to us. I mean, you think about it when you were like grade 7 and you looked at the grade 12ers and you thought, man, they're so old, right? And, you know, there's people like that look at our lives and say, who's a little bit further down the path? Who can I learn from? That's the great thing about the body of Christ. And one of our visions and hopes for life groups here at Coast Hills is that it brings people together who might not otherwise cross paths, right? We become very compartmentalized in life according to our sociological, you know, demographic or our age or whatever. And life groups kind of bring many of those people together and go, okay, I can learn from this person. Let's mentor each other. It's awesome. Another aspect of relationship that Paul looked at and I thought are so key to a joy-filled life is to find those people along the way and understand them and recognize them as true brothers and sisters. Here's what he says about Epaphroditus. He says, "I thought I should send Epaphroditus back to you. He is a true brother." The importance of seeing others in Christian relationship like an extended family. This is the great thing about being a Christ follower. You get a whole nother family. Oftentimes we don't get to choose our family of origin kind of thing, But our family that we get and receive and then reach out to is that family that goes, you know what, God is our Father. And we're His sons and we're His daughters, and together we become brothers and sisters. And I think Paul very affectionately here calls Epaphroditus his true brother. It's that closest kind of deal. It's interesting, I was looking at a book called The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. And he says there's most of us are capable of knowing about 150 people. I don't know how random that is or whatever, but 150 people, he said, they're the kind of people, if you bumped into them, you wouldn't be embarrassed. If uninvited for a coffee, you would sit down with them if you bumped into them at Starbucks kind of thing. So you know all these people. But then within that, he says, there's another group within that 150, and he suggests this group will number between 10 and 15 people. And here's how he says it. Make a list of, he writes, of all the people whose deaths would leave you truly devastated. He says, he calls that the sympathy group. I call that partly this true brother, true sister kind of group. And I think it's that kind of person that you go, you know what? These are the kind of people I want to be with. It's interesting, when Jesus, in his life, he chose 12, right? He chose 12. He says, and it says specifically in the gospel, he says he chose them to be with him. They just hung out. They just kind of together. The Bible has a word for it, fellowship, whatever you want to call it. They lingered together. They just spent time together. They engaged in talking about this most significant relationship, and that was with Jesus, with God. And knowing that that's our commonality. And it might be that we are kind of completely different on a bunch of other levels, but we're coming together as true brothers. And I've learned to see this person as very deep to me because of our common love for Jesus. I think that's a little bit of what happened with the disciples. You know, when you think about it, and you look at the body of Christ, you look at the Christ followers that you might be journeying with, you go, man, they're so different. I mean, their lives are so different. There's this true brotherhood, this true sisterhood that can happen when we say, you know what, we're going to highlight the most important thing. The thing here that matters is, it's what Jesus has done in our life, what He's doing in our life. I look at the people that Jesus had with Him. Think about Matthew, the tax collector, hanging out with Simon the Zealot. Okay, one guy's picking up taxes for Rome, and he's completely in bed with the Roman government. And there's Simon the Zealot trying to overthrow the Roman government. Right? How did those guys do when they started talking politics? You know what happened there? But I think they really became true brothers in their relationship with Jesus. Whatever their different perspectives were, they came together. I think of impulsive Peter hanging out with Thomas, kind of more the doubter kind of end of things. But they became true brothers and sisters. True brothers. I love to think of the life groups at Coast Hills, the kind of relationships, maybe ministry groups and stuff like that, that learn how to do that together. And you know what it's going to take? In order to have the depths of relationship, it's going to take time. It's going to take cutting out the hurry out of our lives. John Ortberg writes a very interesting thing about his move into when he originally went into a new ministry, and he was a pastor at Willow Creek Church, and he writes, you know, I got a hold of a mentor, a friend, to ask him for some spiritual direction. And he says, I described the pace of my life in the current ministry. He says, the church where I serve tends to move at a fast clip. I also told him about our rhythms of family life. We're in the van driving, soccer league, piano lessons, school orientation night years. For those of you who have kids, you understand all about that. I told him about the present condition of my heart as best as I could discern it. What did I need to do, I asked him, to be spiritually healthy? And after a long pause, he says, my mentor said, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. John Ortberg says, okay, I've written that one down. He answered him impatiently. And that's a good one. What else is there? He had a lot of things to do. It was a long-distance phone call. He was anxious to cram in as many units of spiritual wisdom as he could in the least amount of time. There was another long pause. And then his mentor said, there is nothing else. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. If Ortberg eventually got it, he writes, I've concluded that my life and the well-being of the people I serve depends on following his prescription, for hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. He said, hurry destroys souls. I would also say, hurry destroys the joy in our lives, isn't it? And Paul here is just taking a moment to just celebrate and talk about his friends, Timothy and Epaphroditus, and saying, these guys just bring joy to my heart. And I'm just going to enjoy, you know, this is just good stuff. I love what Gordon MacDonald writes. He says, you know, it's good to look at people and say, Who is it that stretches my mind? Who is it that listens to my dreams? Who cries with me? Who laughs with me? Who can rebuke me as well? Who will protect me? It's important to have those kind of true brothers, true sisters in our lives. So Paul celebrates that. And then he goes on, and finally he goes to the riskers and the gamblers. Now, where do I get that? Verse 29, it says, "Welcome him, Epaphroditus, with Christian love and with great joy, and give him the honor that people like him deserve. For he risked his life for the work of Christ, and he was at the point of death while doing for me what you couldn't do from far away." Here's Epaphroditus saying, you know what? I'm not just going to hang out with Paul and just sort of be that brother when, you know, the good times. I'm actually going to go and, in this case, risk my life. I'm willing to step in there and be there with him as he goes through what he's going through. It's interesting to see that the name Epaphroditus, it may have been that his parents could have devoted him. He came from a very Greek kind of background. Could have devoted him to the goddess of love, Epaphroditus. But it's interesting that that god was also, I found it interesting, the patron of gambling. All right. So interestingly enough, one of the ancient writers, Plutarch, writes, he tells us that the highest cast of the dice is called Epaphroditus. His name might mean one blessed with gambler's luck. The great thing is, Epaphroditus didn't use this kind of deal, you know, for financial gain, but he actually used it for the sake of Jesus and what he's doing in the world and how he wanted to reach out and help others, his genuine concern for this world. And so Epaphroditus said, "I'm with you, Paul, on mission." You know, so oftentimes we can kind of just get comfortable where we're at. We also need those friends, those people who walk beside who are the riskers and the gamblers, the people who are able to step out and say, "I'm going to take some risks in my faith. I'm willing to kind of carve out some time and say, you know, I'm going to move towards somebody that I might not, you know, it's towards a mission or something that's just outside of what my regular comfort zone is." There was a group of people actually in the early church who took on that, whatever the Greek word is, I won't try and pronounce it, that really actually describes riskers and gamblers. And there's writings about it where they ministered to the sick and the imprisoned, and they saw to that it that if possible, martyrs and even enemies would receive an honorable burial. And there's a writing about the city of Carthage during the Great Pestilence. And all that means is that people just died of plagues back then, right? Before you learned about germs and washing hands and all the rest of it. In the year 252 A.D., Cyprian, the bishop, it writes, showed remarkable courage. And this is what they write. "In self-sacrificing commitment to his flock and even love for his enemies, he took upon himself the care of the sick and bade his congregation nurse them and bury the dead. What a contrast with the practice of the heathen who were throwing the corpses out of the plague-stricken city and were running away in terror." Now you can imagine, if a plague like that is going through and you don't have modern medicine, what was going on is that people just saying, "I'm just looking out for myself here, you know, just throw the dead out, I'm not even going to touch, you know, whatever it is, I'm just going to isolate myself because something weird is happening, I don't know what." The remarkable thing about these Christians, the early church, is that they were known to actually move towards the people who were sick at great risk to themselves. And in reading some other historians, the irony is that many of these people gave up their lives in the process of moving towards the sick and caring for them. But also what happened is some of these people developed greater antibodies, and they actually said, "We can't wipe out these Christians because they're actually getting stronger and stronger, both spiritually and physically." And the takeaway from this, obviously, is that Epaphroditus was that sort of guy. He says, "You know what? Even if it costs me sickness, I'm moving towards people. I'm going to move towards them." And I think, you know, in our lives, what we can do is look at it and say, "You know what? This might go very contrary to my personality, but am I willing to risk, to gamble, to step out, maybe of my comfort zone, maybe of my normal routine?" And I know when we talk about people who are, you know, death's the at the door kind of thing, that kind of sets the bar way up here. But I think on our practical level in our lives, it's thinking, where do I step out of, you know, the things that I only enjoy doing or that only serve myself or maybe my group of people? How can I serve the sick or serve those in prison or serve those who are marginalized? And maybe even as in life groups, even this week or whatever, you might want to be able to talk about that. Say, how are we moving outward? How are we stepping out? It might be through deed. It might be through word. Maybe it's coming together and finding courage in the fact that, you know what, these other people are praying for me, and I'm going to actually, you know, declare myself as a Christ follower in work. Maybe in some way or another, when I can take the safe road in a conversation and not go there kind of in a talking about Jesus, I'm going to talk about him. And it's going to maybe feel kind of risky, and who knows how that kind of will affect the relationship, but I'm willing to do that. The riskers and the gamblers, we need those kind of people who come alongside us and say, you can do it. Take courage from being together in it. I love what Nelson Mandela writes in his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. He describes the 30 years he spent on Robben Island. And he says, the authorities' greatest mistake was to keep us together, for together our determination was reinforced. We supported each other and gained strength from each other. Whatever we knew, whatever we learned, we shared, and by sharing, we multiplied whatever courage we had individually. That is not to say that we were all alike in our responses to hardships we suffered. Men have different capacities and react differently to stress, but the stronger ones raised up the weaker ones, and both became stronger in the process. We need people who come alongside of us and go, you know what, you can do it. We're going to do this together. Let's get strong together. I think God is incredibly excited when he sees a church, when he sees a group of people say, you know what, we're going to take the hill together. We're moving outward. We're reaching out. We're stepping outside of our comfort zones to care for others, to be a voice, to be a heart that's there to genuinely care. We're going to take communion here together just now. And I love what it says in John 15, verse 13. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And ultimately, as we know from this passage in Philippians 2, Jesus did that for us. That's what we celebrate in communion, is a friend coming to us in our point of need, doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. That Jesus would be a risker and a gambler in that way. That God would come and risk all, gamble all, for the sake of the honor of God and for the sake of the love and care for our souls, and that he would give ourselves. So this morning I would hope that we could maybe raise these cups together and say, you know, this is like a toast to our friend Jesus. He truly is a friend. He's a kindred spirit. When you think about who Jesus is, nobody knows our hearts and our souls and gets inside of our head like Jesus does. That's the kind of friend that we have in Jesus. Nobody else can give us the kind of wisdom that we need, can be a true mentor like Jesus. And there's no one else who can be a true brother. He says, I call you my friends. It comes alongside of us. As we take communion this morning, I hope that you can take those images and say, that's the kind of Jesus that's a friend to me. And that's the kind of Jesus that can fill up my soul to actually give me what I need in friendships on a human level as well. I want to invite the worship band to come up, I guess, and to help us to lead together. And I want to invite you to, this morning, as they lead in a song in a moment, if you'd like to take communion this morning, we want to invite you. If Jesus is your friend, your kindred spirit, your mentor, your true brother, someone who you know has risked and gambled all for you, to take communion this morning. And I think Peter and Diane and Rob and Cheryl and Urban Christine are each going to take an aisle and have the cups and the bread.